And joining us on Perspectives today is Marie Arana. Marie is the author, editor, journalist, literary critic, and member of the Scholars Council of the Library of Congress. She is the author of the recent book, Silver, Sword, and Stone, Three Crucibles in the Latin American Story. And we are joined right now by Marie. She's going to tell us a little bit about her background and what happened in this book, what drove her to write this. Let me just basically talk a little bit about this book. As Marie kind of weaves in the stories and the history of the past millennium to explain three enduring themes that have defined Latin America since pre-Columbian times, the foreign greed, the mineral riches, and ungrain propensity to violence, and the abiding power of religion, thus silver, sword, and stone. Marie, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Louis. Thank you for having me.
Let's start, first of all, with your background. Tell us a little bit about you growing up.
Absolutely. I was born in Lima, Peru, and I was the child of a Peruvian father and an American mother. They had met when my father had gone to school during the war, where they were bringing all sorts of Latin boys up to take the places of American boys who'd gone off to war. So he came up to study and met my mother in Boston and brought her back down to Peru. And I was the product. I was born in Lima, Peru. I thought of myself as completely Peruvian because my whole family, huge family, of course, I was in the embrace of this wonderful family. And my mother was the only American I knew. So she was sort of the odd person out in the family, so to speak. So I had a completely Peruvian first 10 years of my life, although my mother did teach us English. And then at the age of 10, I came as an immigrant to my mother's country, and we all came at that point, and we came to New Jersey, and that's where I did the rest of my growing up as a Hispanic American. So it was, you know, the first 10 years of my life thinking, you know, that's who I was, totally Peruvian, and then coming to the United States and trying to be part of this, you know, sort of great American experience, but really with a father who then became the person who was the odd man out. So I've seen identity from two sides.
So tell us a little bit about, well, we're all familiar with what's been going on in the news about immigrants coming here, seeking asylum, a lot of people crossing borders, trying to assimilate into the culture as you and your family did. Can you tell us a little bit about what you experienced as a 10-year-old little girl coming in to a strange country? As you mentioned, you were Peruvian for the first 10 years of your life. Not that that changed any when you came to America, but I'm sure that it was a little bit hard to adjust.
Absolutely, absolutely. Very hard to adjust at the time. When I came, it was in the middle of the civil rights struggle, and I remember being told as a little girl, oh, you're going to the United States, you're going to the land of wonder, where you can basically eat off the streets because everything's so clean. You can drink the water from the rivers because everything's so pure. You will have opportunities that you would never have in this country, and then to arrive in the United States when children are being hosed, you know, by the police in the streets of the South of the United States, where you know, there is children are being shot in a church in the South of the United States. And wondering, well, you know, and seeing actual bathrooms at the time coming up, because we drove up from Florida to New Jersey, seeing, you know, bus stations that forbade blacks from going into bathrooms. And it was this question of, well, gee, what color am I? And what's going to be, you know, this is a dangerous place. It was a shock, a sort of a culture shock to think that all that had been promised was not actually the reality. And I think that this is what many immigrants today are. This is nothing new. This is what immigrants face, you know, the promise of America and then the realities of it, which are sometimes very, very difficult to live through.
Well, in your book, and I want to talk about this book, the latest book, Silver, Sword, and Stone, Three Crucibles in the Latin American Story, you talk a little bit about, not a little bit, quite a bit, actually, weaving the story, taking us back into history. I mean, I was going back to my school days when I was learning about the Cortez, Cabeza de Vaca, all these people. And you tell us a little bit about that. But what you tell us right from the beginning is that it has not been easy. Latin America has been through some turbulent times, still going through those times. And one of the facts that jumped out at me was the fact, like, about Mexico, and that in 25 years they had 28 different governments.
Yes, and it's the same can be said for Peru or, you know, other countries. There is this cycle, I think, that we go through in Latin American countries, that it's a very volatile cycle, that there is this wish for more independence, more equality, more human and civil rights, and then there is sort of a moment when people really want this so much that they are willing to go, you know, to the barricades and revolt. And then there are brief periods of what you might call attempts at democracy, and then there are sort of repressive forces come in to tamp that down. And this cycle has gone on in so many of the Latin American countries that there it's by now something that we're used to. I also think that, you know, in Latin America, we don't have a gloss on sort of the ourselves as ideal. We do not. We don't see ourselves as ideal, which is why, as little children, you're told, you know, America's so great, you know, there's a great future there. There is a gloss in this country about the liberties and the human rights and all of that and the equality. And so Latin America, I think we grow up with a certain mentality that, you know, things are imperfect. And we're very realistic about that imperfection. I think there's a very, very different sort of frame of mind that we have.
We talk about technology, about things that have come to be known here in the world. Yet in your book, you write about, well, 500 years ago, before the Spanish conquista, the region we call Latin America was pretty much one of the most advanced civilizations on the planet.
Absolutely. Advanced in so many ways, and certainly in the arts, in technology, that there was no use of the wheel. But, you know, there this extraordinary monuments, and you know, when you think of the rocks that were dragged up the hills to build Machu Picchu, and the tremendous accomplishments of the Aztec and the Mayan culture, and the Muisca in Colombia, and the Inca, of course, in Peru, tremendous accomplishments. Also, you have to say, tremendous violence along with those accomplishments, because these were cultures that had been accustomed to a great deal of violence. Some of the cultures even condoned cannibalism, you know, and there was I'm not saying that things were perfect, but they were definitely reduced. The indigenous cultures were completely dismembered and reduced after the conquest. It was a very, very cataclysmic clash of cultures.
When you describe the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayas, sometimes in our mind we think, well, these are these small little groups, villages. They live somewhere. The ruler has a big house. Everything is going good for him. But we don't realize just how many people actually were out there. Like in the book, you write about the Incas. They controlled as many as 37 million people.
Yes, and they had an empire that stretched north-south as far as this country, the United States, stretches east-west. You know, it was a huge dominion that they had with millions of people. And very much controlled. The first thing that the Inca did was to convert people into their religion, which was the worship of the sun. It was a tremendous kind of operation, and the Inca road that was built to connect all of it was an enormous undertaking, and really an extraordinary feat. And the same can be said for the Aztec and the Maya, that were extremely developed, highly developed. And the Maya had quite a developed language and written system. The others didn't. The Aztecs and the Inca did not, but they used different forms of preserving history. So the extent, the power was huge. I mean, this was the Inca Empire, for instance, was larger than any other empire present in the planet at the time.
We're visiting with Marie Arana. Her latest book is Silver, Sword, and Stone. And Marie, as far as the Incas, Mayas, Aztecs, as we've been discussing them, you just mentioned a little bit about, you know, the languages and everything that they had so advanced. People don't realize that these civilizations also had, well, they developed actually sophisticated systems of agriculture, engineering, timekeeping, and astronomy. And, you know, we're all familiar. I know here in El Paso, downtown El Paso, we have a big Mayan calendar, downtown Maya or Aztec. I don't remember. Which was the ones that developed the calendar?
Yes, the Mayans developed the calendar.
Okay,
and
yes.
And it was, an extraordinary and a beautiful thing. You know, yes, they had developed culture to a great extent. In fact, the canals that exist in the Inca Empire are still functional. It's extraordinary that the road that was built is still functional. The highly organized, the sort of merchant chains that the Aztecs had and the Mayans had were highly developed. The whole trade system, I mean, going up and down territories, you know, encompassing many, many tribes, they had learned to trade. They had learned to a tremendous system of agriculture that was able to feed the people. It was a very large population, much, much larger, I think, than we've imagined. Now that it is clear from research and from the evidence that this was you think of, particularly in the United States, the pioneers coming in and seeing open land. Well, not so in Latin America and Central America and the Caribbean. These were very populated areas with, you know, established populations.
And this was something that, of course, the Spaniards, when they arrived, they marveled at what they saw.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful passage of Cortes's men who are, advancing into the city of Tenochtitlan, which was Mexico City under the Aztecs, and being absolutely bowled over by what they saw, because it was like a Venice. You know, there were these canals, there were these floatings, seemingly floating islands with great monuments and great pyramids on them. There were ships or boats that were sailing down the canals, you know, in beautifully closed residents who were welcoming them and trading and, you know, bringing them into the city. It was an extraordinary sight. And in one case, I think one of the chroniclers said it was like out of a dream. You know, this city rose up, you know, glistening white, you know, with it, all of this structures that we had never imagined in sort of fiction. It seemed like something out of a novel, and that was exactly what this chronicler said, because at the time there were all these romance novels of conquering, you know, Constantinople or conquering this or that, and so he said this was even bigger than Constantinople or any romance that we had ever heard.
One of the passages that caught my attention in your book as well is the fact that when Cortes goes in and he sees Montezuma, Montezuma is lavished with all these wonderful medals that really don't mean anything to them, but to the Spaniards, all of a sudden, the sense of greed comes in.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was like, you know, suddenly somebody looking at your hat and saying, oh, my God, look at that treasure. I mean, for Montezuma, it was basically a hat. You know, he was wearing things on his ears, and this was just a symbol of who he was. And, of course, Cortes then writes back to the king, oh, my God, if you could see this, the barbarians' baubles, he called them, immediately evident to me that this is a tremendously rich culture in precious metals, which is what they were after, you know.
We're visiting with Marie Arana. Her new book is called Silver, Sword, and Stone. And Marie, if you wouldn't mind, let's talk a little bit about how did this come about? Because a lot of research went into this book. It's very obvious. At what point did you decide to tackle something like this?
Oh, my. You know, this is a book that's been a product of 6 years of hard work. The seemed daunting the whole time that I was doing it, because it seemed this vast amount of information that I wanted to get across to tell the story of a kind of trajectory that we have passed through as Hispanics, as Latinos, who, you know, what have we come from that is makes us different in many, many ways to sort of the usual sort of American model. We bring history with us. And to try to bring all that history with me to tell the story was a tremendous undertaking. I didn't, you know, I sort of dove into it in the beginning thinking, I want to tell a big story, bigger story than even Simón Bolívar, which was my last book. Simón Bolívar, of course, it liberated, you know, six republics. It was a huge story. It went all the way from Caracas all the way down to Bolivia. But it was a story that, you know, encompassed also 500 years, because his forebears landed in Venezuela in the 1500s. So it was. I thought that's a wonderful way to tell the story of the revolutions and, you know, how we became the countries that we are down there. And then I thought, I want to do something larger. I want to tell the story of an identity. I want to tell the story of where we've come from, and the baggage that we bring with us. And, you know, right away, I knew that I needed to carve it down to these three things, which I've tried to focus on, which I think are the three things that really have defined us in very deep ways. The silver, which is the, of course, the despoliation, so shall we say, that the predatory nature of outside cultures wanting what Latin America can offer in terms of just, you know, the precious metals, the agriculture, the taking, I guess, is what I mean by silver. A sword is just the violence that we've always had with us way back from indigenous times. And, of course, the stone is the religion that has largely been, you know, over the years imposed, you know, even back in the indigenous time, as I just described, the Inca would conquer and then proselytize and then convert the conquered tribes into their religion. Well, that was just something that went on, has gone on for a millennium. So I wanted to tell this, organize the story in these three things that I think have actually moved populations and have defined us, not our happy parts, not the parts that love poetry and music and you know, have warm souls, which we all do, but the difficult parts, that sort of the things that we have actually encountered through history that have made us the way we are.
We're visiting with Marie Arana. Her book is Silver, Sword, and Stone, Three Crucibles in the Latin American Story. And as you just went through these three crucibles, I would kind of like to break it down a little bit more. Because when people see or hear those three words, silver, sword, stone, they go, oh, well, you know, words, I can identify this with that. But when you broke it down like you have in your book, where you explain, hey, silver is not just, you know, something that is shiny and it glows, whatever you want it to do. But silver is something that led. It was the lust for precious metals that these conquistadores and other people came. And that led not to just them getting those precious metals, but a lot of exploitation, slavery, cruelty, death, a lot of blood spill.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, I hope by the end of this book, you see that these three things, the exploitation that is represented by silver, the violence that's represented by the sword, and religion that's represented by stone, all of these three things actually play together. They're knit together by the end of it, because they all sort of relate to each other. They all marched through history together. Pulling out, you know, what are the strongest messages that we have been given, that and the lessons that we've been taught by history, and this is it. I mean, this is the way that the greed that we have been subject to. We are very accustomed to the spilling of blood. Terrible to say, but it's true all through history, and now in the contemporary age. We are in the top 10 most violent cities in the world, they're all in that territory. You know, we have to accept that this is so. And at the same time, we have to accept that there's a reason why. There's a history behind it. There are these exploitations and a conquest, the mentality of conquest that still lives with us, the tremendous inequalities that still exist in Latin America, always have and still exist. So it is in many ways, and many historians have said this before, the most unequal place on earth. There are the very rich, the very powerful, and there are the very poor, the abject and desperately poor.
No middle class.
Yes. Growing, but still, you know, always tenuous, because we always feel, and this is true in Mexico as much as it is in Peru, it's certainly true in Argentina right now, that has just, you know, suddenly the currency has lost 30% of its value. I mean, we live in a tenuous way in that middle class. You know, I think that, you know, there always is the fear and the possibility that you're going to slip.
We are visiting with award-winning author Marie Arana. Her book is Silver Sword and Stone, Three Crucibles in the Latin American Story. As we kind of wrap up last 5 minutes or so here, Marie, you break down these crucibles, silver sword and stone, and you include with each crucible a character. And, for example, with silver, you introduce us to Leonor Gonzalez, and she lives in 18,000 feet above sea level in the Andean Cordillera of Peru. And what she's doing is actually not very much different from what was going on years ago.
Absolutely. She is doing essentially what her ancestors 500 years ago did. So much of what I learned in the process of writing this book is that the illegal mining, which is to say the mining that is done with no official oversight and no police oversight, no government oversight, all of that illegal mining is the largest producer of mining goods, of metals, and in all of Latin America. So though there are many large corporations with developed sort of instruments of mining and huge up kind of very large corporate investments into, say, Cajamarca or in Mexico, basically what the largest producer of precious metals is illegal. And in these illegal places, people live in the most difficult circumstances and with backbreaking work, you know, producing gold that then goes you know, down the road to the big city, across the ocean, to the fancy counters of Tiffany's in New York and, you know, Cartier's in Paris and off. But, you know, basically the mining that's being done is being done in conditions that are incredibly, shockingly primitive. And the people who are involved in it at the very bottom, who are actually digging the earth and bringing out this precious metal, have very, very difficult, dangerous, and short-lived lives.
The second crucible is sword, and you talk about the display of power, brutality, coercion, and you call it la mano dura, the iron fist, and then you introduce us to Carlos Huergos.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Carlos is Cuban. It was sort of a ne'er-do-well as a young man, and then he was drafted into the military in Cuba and sent to Angola, where he was toughened to the extreme, because that was a very, very savage and bitter war that was conducted in Angola, and a way for Castro to show, you know, that this was a developed country. If you can send warriors to fight somebody else's war across the seas in other lands, you are a powerful country. And he was trying to prove that by sending Cuban soldiers, and tens of thousands of Cuban soldiers went to Angola to fight in the war. And in that war, Carlos became, was accustomed to a very, very savage way of killing, came back to Cuba, and then it fell into life in crime. And then, of course, when the he out of prison, he was sort of liberated during the Mariel boat lifts and sent down to that shore in Mariel, put on a boat and sent to Key West to suddenly become an American. You know, and here comes this person who's been ravaged by the experience of war and desperately trying to get a living in Cuba by slaughtering horses and doing crimes that ended him up in jail, suddenly is let loose in the cities of America and told, you know, go and make a life. Well, you know, that violence, that acculturation to violence that happened in Carlos is something I think that's symbolic of a kind of acculturation of violence that we all may experience. If we don't actually experience violence in Latin America, we're always afraid of it. We always worry about it. We are concerned about it. We are very conservative, I think, in so many ways because we're careful, is what I mean by conservative. Very, very careful, cautious people in that regard because we know that violence could be around the corner. And so that's the story of Carlos.
And finally, the third crucible, the stone, and we all are familiar with stories of religion causing war, very things done in the name of religion. There have been different books written, like The Cathedral by the Sea, Alfonso del Falcones, and then Ken Follett's Pillar of Fire. And you talk about that here in how those stones have been used to promote their own agenda.
Yes, yes. You know, it's always struck me the fact that, and you go to Mexico City, and you go to the center of the city, and you see that the big cathedral in the middle of the city is built right on top of the pyramid of, what was it called, the Adoratorium of Moctezuma, and right at the foot of the cathedral. So it's almost as if, you know, I am slapping my stone on your stone. And not only that, I'm taking your stone to make my temple of faith. And it was a very strong lesson that the Spaniards used. They always built the cathedrals, the churches, on sort of sacred land that was sacred to the indigenous. So it was, you know, here, we're taking over your spiritual life, and not only that, we're making a very physical display of it, and a very powerful and an even grander sort of display. And it's something that has always struck me because it's a form of conquest in itself, of course, and it's a form of violence in itself. I mean, to actually completely derail, dismember, and make forbidden a religion in order to impose your own.
Marie, I'm sure that we didn't cover everything that is included in this wonderful book. If you wouldn't mind giving us a webpage or somewhere else that people can go online to find out more about this book and you?
Oh, absolutely. Please go to my website, which is www.mariearana.net, or to www.simonandschuster.com, which is my publisher, Simon & Schuster.
Thank you so much for being with us. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, Louis. It's a pleasure. All the best.
We've been visiting with award-winning author Marie Arana. The name of the book is Silver Sword and Stone, Three Crucibles in the Latin American Story. Perspectives is taped and produced in the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. We had help from Chris Williams. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.